It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, 3 weeks ago, the sale of one county-operated nursing home was completed. The agreement was reached on another. We'll talk about the privatization of county-run nursing homes. But first, the results are in from the latest tests on lead in Pittsburgh's water, and Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority is in compliance just barely. We're going to discuss this progress, but a lot of work still to do to address the cause of the lead in the water with WESA reporter Liz Reed, who covers health, science, and technology. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks for inviting me, Kevin.
And Teresa Cliff, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Teresa, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
If you have a question or comment, tweet us and use the hashtag WESA Confluence. So Tuesday, PWSA announced that it was in compliance with EPA standards for lead levels in drinking water. First, you two, a little background. What is the compliance level and where was the city at its worst that we know of?
Well, so last summer we were at 22 parts per billion. And the way that they measure that number is they do water quality testing at a certain number of homes, and they look at the 90th percentile. So for the sake of argument, let's say they're testing 100 homes. That's just a number I'm using. If 10 or more homes are above 15 parts per billion, you're out of compliance. So PWSA's test came back right at 15 parts per billion, not above. So technically, they are in compliance.
Yeah, I actually reached out to the EPA on that, too, because it seemed odd to me they were right at that level. And the EPA told me that if a water system comes back between 15 and 15.5, they rounded down to 15. So they confirmed they are in compliance, but they actually have to test again in 6 months and come in at 15 or below again in order to technically not be exceeding the level anymore and have that 7% replacement of lead lines lifted they have to do.
So is this water for the test taken like right from the tap, from the faucet inside a home, or is it the water, do they test the water somehow below ground, if you
know. No, it's taken right from the tap, and about after a 6 hour, they ask the homeowners to let the water sit for 6 hours. So overnight, or maybe right when you get home from work, when the water's just been sitting in the pipe all day, you take that first draw from the tap.
It sounds like a major improvement, 22 parts per billion at its worst last June, right?
Mm-hmm.
So June, a year ago, I should say, and now 15. Sounds like a lot of progress, but how are people viewing this, or are we getting different takes on whether it's a lot of progress or not?
I mean, the city feels pretty good about it. They had sort of nothing. There was a statement from the mayor. He had nothing but good things to say about the improvement. PWSA is obviously happy with the improvement. As you know, Kevin, County Controller Chelsea Wagner sent out a statement and felt that the improvement was not significant enough.
Yeah. Teresa, she said that, okay, but there's still danger. There's still danger, and don't use this as a way to spin good news or make good news out of something that is still potentially a danger.
Yeah, and she called attention. She took issue also with the fact that there were fewer samples taken this time than there were 6 months ago, about 20 or so fewer. And I reached out to PWSA, and the reason for that is they send sample kits to the same 200 homes each 6 months that they believe have lead lines or lead plumbing. And they, beyond the 200, it's just voluntary who sends it back, and they're only required to have 100. So they say that's why it went down.
So they sent out to the same, but 200. Fewer responded? Is
correct.
That what we're getting?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So
but it's still above the 100 they're required to send them out to.
Okay. So what do we know was done from last June of 16 till now, to lower these levels from 22 parts to 15 parts? What was the process that was undertaken to do that?
Bob Weimar, who is the interim executive director one of several PWSA has had in recent years. He said it was basically changes in corrosion control. They're using lime and soda ash, which are approved by the State Department of Environmental Protection. And in 2014, as some listeners might remember, Veolia, which was the private company managing PWSA at the time, had switched to another chemical, caustic soda, and that was not approved by the DEP. And PWSA eventually was fined for that unauthorized change. So Bob Weimar says they have changed back, and that has improved the corrosion control.
Well, let's hear from Bob Weimar right now.
The intent is to use a phosphate-based compound, which has been shown nationwide to have the highest degree of effectiveness in mitigating this type of corrosion.
Yeah, so they're going to ask DEP for permission. So DEP has to approve the chemical that they use. And this phosphate-based compound is not currently one that they've asked for permission for or had approved. So they're going to ask for permission to use that. And Weimar says it's been really effective in other cities. And he told City Council on Wednesday that it would significantly reduce the lead level such that the lead line replacement program can happen at, quote, a more reasonable pace.
So let's get this straight now. It's the DEP, the state, that has to approve this, not the EPA, which sets the 15 parts per billion. We have the state and the feds getting involved, correct?
Correct.
All right. So what's your sense of going forward? Do they expect this now when they do start using the new compound to reduce it more? What's the anticipation, Teresa?
Yes, I believe they expect the new chemical to really drop it pretty low, pretty close to no lead, a lot faster than the process of replacing the lead lines. They are under the order to replace 7% of all their lead lines. The deadline for that was June 30th, so that would have been just over 1,300 that they would have had to replace. They ended up replacing just over 400, so they're in talks with DEP, but they're anticipating some sort of civil penalty. The details aren't set yet.
Right. And Liz, they stopped the partial lead line replacements.
That's right. They stopped in June after testing in a handful of homes. I should say it's just 4 of 8 homes that were tested, so they only got results at that time. They only had water quality results from 8 homes. So half of those showed elevated lead levels. And we knew this was a possibility. The EPA has put out research saying that this is a possibility. And Kevin Acklin was testifying in front of City Council this week. And he said he's the mayor's chief of staff. And he said that as soon as he heard about those elevated levels, he said, "We're stopping this program." He knew they might be fined. And indeed, sounds like they're going to be fined.
Well, let's talk about the Peduto administration. They had been waiting on a bill in Harrisburg that would give PWSA permission, I guess, to replace the lines from the curbs into the homes. I talked with the mayor last week, and he was definitely upset with some of the state legislative leaders.
So although the State House passed a bill which would have PWSA under the PUC, when the bill that would actually help the people of Pittsburgh with the safety of their lead was added into it, it all of a sudden became a poison pill to some of the leadership in Harrisburg, and they have refused to move it. So we'll move it in Pittsburgh. That may potentially put the city in a position where we may be sued. We think that our chances are pretty good.
Okay, so we just, Liz, you mentioned Kevin Acklin says, well, we might get fined with not hitting the 7%. By the timetable. And now the mayor says, well, we could get sued by proceeding without the state approval. Is this because of they're in conflict, in competition with private plumbers?
Yeah, so it's like it's a pretty convoluted situation that's going on right now, because the proposed law that Peduto is talking about was introduced by Senator Wayne Fontana. And it doesn't change the law that PWSA cites as having been cited in a previous lawsuit against the authority, which is the Municipal Authorities Act. It actually, and that's the part that says they can't compete against private businesses. So these private businesses would, in theory, would be contracted to replace the private side of your line, and you would pay them as a homeowner. So Fontana's bill actually changes a portion of state law called the municipalities generally. And it just explicitly says cities or city authorities like PWSA can go ahead and replace the private side of the lead water service lines when they're replacing the public side. But that bill, according to Peduto and Senator Fontana, is stalled in the House. Now, Steve Miskin, who's the spokesperson for the Republican caucus in the House, called me after I put out an article about this, saying that Peduto's comments were ludicrous and that the bill wasn't dead, that it could still be voted on, but that some people in the House had some major problems with it. And I should note that it did pass unanimously in the Senate and in a House committee, but Miskin basically said the budget is the priority right now, which is why that bill isn't moving.
Yeah. Okay, Teresa.
Yeah, and PWSA says they would still prefer the state bill to pass. They would prefer that to be the way that it's done. But, you know, if that doesn't happen this session, the city council legislation would work, they believe, for what they need to do to be able to replace the whole line.
Yeah, and so the city bill basically says the city enters into an agreement with the homeowner, not PWSA. So the city sort of acts as an intermediary. So it'll be interesting to see how the courts interpret that, if they interpret that as still PWSA essentially competing with these private companies.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that city legislation. So after a few weeks of tabling these proposals, City Council took action Wednesday. Let's listen first to the mayor's chief of staff, Kevin Ackland. Then we're going to hear from council members Dan Gilman, Bruce Krause, Corey O'Connor, and Daniel Lavelle.
This has been a private issue. We're socializing the solution here, meaning that we're taking public ownership of this public health problem.
If you are, and I'm making the numbers up, but if you are have three children and make $75,000 and your line is 43 feet long, that may be a much greater hardship than someone who makes $42,000, has no kids, and has a 8-foot line.
Perfect is the enemy of the good. This is good, and it's a proper step forward, and I encourage us to take it today. Madam Clerk, may we have a roll call, please?
I disagree with doing an amendment at the table for two brand new bills at 7:45 in the morning and finding out that residents are going to pay. So I'm not voting on this today.
Ultimately, this actually becomes a budget discussion for council. And I think we're going to have to budget into this activity taking place next year.
All right. We heard some objections to it. So preliminary approval?
Yeah, preliminary approval, 6 yeses, 1 abstention. We heard Corey O'Connor say he was abstaining, but he actually left the room before the vote was taken. So it's not an official abstention. He just didn't have a vote counted.
Teresa.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to note that it's not fully clear that they can't be replacing the full line, and they couldn't have been this whole time. It's not clear whether that 2011 court decision really bars them from that, and even Senator Fontana himself says he's not so sure. This bill he's proposing is just to make it extra clear that they can.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That comment from Councilman Lavelle was interesting. He called it a budget issue. Why? Is this going to cost the city? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Well, so technically, the city is the one entering into the agreement with the homeowner to do the work under this city council bill. So that's how they're getting around the law that says PWSA can't compete with private businesses to do the work, even though PWSA contractors and subcontractors will be doing the work. And that's specified in the bill. So the city's an intermediary, and obviously it will cost money to do these replacements. So where's this money going to come from? Lavelle was basically saying that he anticipates this being a big part of capital budget discussions this fall. And of course, we'll be covering those.
So is it coming from ratepayers? Is it coming from the city's operating budget?
There's sort of two details of this that haven't figured out where the money's coming from. And the other money issue that hasn't been figured out is who gets this no cost? Because that was one of the changes, was that the bill changed from being no cost to the homeowner to no cost or reduced cost. So that's where a little bit of pushback, where we heard Corey O'Connor say, and all of a sudden now you're saying my constituents could be charged, and I'm not sure about this. And we heard Dan Gilman saying, how are we going to determine it? Is it going to be just monthly income? Is that actually fair? So that's the other part, is the mechanism to determine, the sort of formula to determine who has to pay, who gets it for free, how much would you have to pay, if you have to pay, what kind of criteria are taken into account.
Yeah, the city applied for a grant too, right, that they might get for that? Or
yeah. And so,
I mean, there are URA, there is a URA grant program for people to do the private line replacements. And you know, in theory, this kind of piggybacks on something else we've been covering, which is the affordable housing, the Housing Opportunity Fund that council has been talking about. In theory, that could be something that people could apply for, grants or you know, no interest loans, potentially from that fund to do this kind of improvement. But both of these things are there's a lot of moving parts right now, and they're not, you know, council's not sure and the administration's not sure, I think, yet how all this is going to play out.
Unsure, uncertainty. One thing we do know, that replacing these lead lines, whoever is paying for it, partially by the homeowner, the city, ratepayers, whatever, we know it's going to take years and years to do. So I'd like to ask both of you in our remaining minute and a half, what are you as reporters looking ahead to? What are you curious about in the next weeks, months, and even years ahead? We'll start with you, Teresa.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to keep following these talks that have been happening between the DEP and PWSA. They've been with the attorneys so far, but I understand they're going to start to be include more officials soon. And Bob Weimar hopes to get a decision on that by August 1st on what the citation or civil penalty might be, how much it might be. He says, don't worry, it's not going to affect our operations and all our programs. So that's definitely something to follow.
Yeah, and piggybacking off of that, another thing that happens to be in this city council bill is that the city will have a consent order and agreement with DEP by September 15th. That is the date that is set out in a proposed, you know, change to city code. So we should be seeing in the coming months what that consent order and agreement looks like, and that is likely going to address the issue of line replacements. You know, the other thing I'd like to see is, how is the public reacting? And obviously, you know, anyone out there who's listening, tweet us, get in touch. How do you feel about the 15 parts per billion? Do you feel this is an acceptable level? Does this feel like compliance to you as someone who's drinking this water every day?
All right. Liz Reed is a health, science, and technology reporter for WESA. Teresa Clift is reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks.
Coming up, more nearby counties are getting out of the nursing home business. Will this impact Allegheny County's Kane Nursing Centers? That's next when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Katie Zolkowski. A new affordable housing complex is being built in the city's Squirrel Hill neighborhood. It'll be constructed on the former site of the Poli restaurant and will have units available for households making less than $34,000 per year. And it's kitty season. The East End location of the Humane Animal Rescue League is overflowing with stray cats. The shelter estimates it takes in nearly 2,000 cats per month in the summer and is hoping for new adoptions. Find more at WESA.fm.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 3 weeks ago, Washington County agreed to sell its nursing home to Premier Healthcare Management. 2 days later, Premier completed the purchase of Armstrong County's nursing home. Is it a trend? And if so, will that trend include Allegheny County's Kane Nursing Centers? We're going to address the privatization of nursing homes with Gary Rotstein, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. If you have a question or comment, please tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Welcome, Gary. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Not too many people want to talk about nursing homes with me, especially my editors and colleagues.
Well, we want to, and I'm sure it's of interest to this community, given the age of this community as well. So, Gary, is it truly a trend, this move of counties getting away from operating their own nursing homes?
It's been going on for at least a decade across Pennsylvania, and it's gotten especially concentrated in the past few years in our neck of the woods in southwestern Pennsylvania. Not Allegheny County, but almost all the counties surrounding us have sold their nursing homes in recent years.
Any idea why you mentioned our neck of the woods, per se?
I think it's just a coincidence of timing as far as why that's happening around here now as opposed to 2 or 4 or 6 years ago. It could be partly because the labor unions are pretty strong in southwestern Pennsylvania. A lot of nursing home workers and county-owned homes are employed in labor or represented by unions like SEIU, and that can be a holdup sometimes because county commissioners may not want to antagonize any unions by selling off homes.
Okay. So you talked about the trend. You talked about it happening here. I believe I heard somewhere, read somewhere, I should say, that at its peak, now, of course, Pennsylvania, 67 counties, but that at least 50 counties had at one time nursed their own nursing homes. But right now, where were we as far as counties across the state? It's about half of what it was 18, maybe a dozen years ago?
18 counties right now, including Allegheny and Westmoreland in our area, and that is half of what it was in 2004.
So it was 36 down to 18, and as you said, a lot in our area, southwestern Pennsylvania, have privatized.
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, that's a total of, you said 18, but of course, Allegheny County has 4, so the additional 3, so it's actually 21 homes, right?
Correct.
So that's 21 out of, I believe it's like 700 or so nursing homes across the state. I was talking to Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald, and I know you talked with him as well for a story that you did. I was speaking to him this week about this issue and why nearby counties were selling off their nursing homes. He blamed it on the scale of their economies, not as diverse maybe as Allegheny County or the size of Allegheny County. Is that what you got in – did you get that sense as well?
That's a good part of it. The nursing home – business is a tough business these days. The margins of profitability are small, it seems, even for the best private operators. But the way they are able at least to make a small profit in most cases is because if you have multiple facilities and they're large enough, you can deal with vendors in a way where you get a lot of favorable contracts, right, and negotiations. If you are a county that has one nursing home of 100 or 200 or 300 beds, that's not, you can do nothing comparable in the way of economies of scale across the board that these large operators can do.
Okay. I believe on any given day, there's approximately 1,000 residents combined at the 4 Canes. And the bulk of the cost is covered through reimbursement.
By Medicaid, primarily. There's some by Medicare. There's some people who private pay. But in both of those cases, it's much smaller in a county-owned home. Most nursing homes, the majority of the population are Medicaid reimbursed. It's even larger in county-owned homes. And Medicaid reimbursements are smaller on a daily basis than is the case for Medicare or for what people pay privately. And that is part of the reason it is tough for county homes to be profitable. Virtually none of them are. They become a drain on a county's budget. And it's just when they become too large a drain that commissioners start looking, saying, hey, maybe this isn't the right thing for us to be doing. Let's sell off our home. And they can take a cash windfall as well by selling off a home to a private operator like Premier for $10, $20, $30 million, depending on the size of the home.
Well, I believe the county's budget is somewhere around $860 million, and County Executive Fitzgerald said that the county kicks in at this point about $1 million. And let's hear what he had to say.
We will continue to make, you know, decisions to try to protect people in Allegheny County as best we can. And again, for the foreseeable future, the Canes look to be in good shape.
Now, $1 million, Gary, out of a budget that size doesn't seem like a lot, but did you get a sense of what the nursing homes were costing the other nearby counties who did decide to privatize?
Well, for example, Armstrong County, if I understand right, had a similar loss, similar in dollar number of about $1 million. But their budget is a small fraction of what Allegheny County's is. So the dollar loss was comparable, but the hit that represents as a percentage of the budget is so much larger that the head of the Armstrong County Commissioners told me they just couldn't afford it, and they have no willingness or desirability to be in the nursing home business at this point.
So what are counties doing? What are they trying to do to, you know, sort of minimize the cost? So if they want to continue to operate, is it just efficiencies? Are they converting beds to more behavior health units, to dementia units? What?
Here at the Canes, it's exactly what you're talking about. Here at the Canes, Dennis Biondo, who runs those facilities, told me that if they had continued being a traditional nursing home, doing the way they things the way they've done them for decades, relying on operating normal beds, there would have been fewer and fewer beds occupied. The dollar losses would have got worse and worse. So they looked at adding dementia-specific facilities, and there is such increasingly high levels of dementia. Those beds have been filled at much higher rates. They are looking at behavioral units for people with different kinds of emotional, mental health problems who need a place to stay. Those have been occupied at higher rates. So that is part of what has enabled the Canes to survive in a way that they were losing as much as $10 million a decade ago. So while they're still losing money, it's a much smaller pace than what was the case in the past, and it seems to be something tolerable to the present administration.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together. We're talking about the privatization of county-owned nursing homes and how this could impact residents, costs, accessibility, etc. We're talking with Gary Rotstein, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. So let's talk about access for residents to the homes. Nicholas Castle, you know him. He's a professor at Pitt's Graduate School of Public Health. He says there's a nationwide trend of nonprofit nursing homes turning into for-profit nursing homes. Most of the time, he said the transition isn't an issue, but the issue does lie with access to them.
Both residents and family, and rightly so, like facilities that are close to where they live so they can visit. It does end up more problematic if you're the sole community provider or you're one of the sole community providers.
All right. So the access is an issue, I guess, if you're in a more outlying area, more of a rural area, where your choices aren't great, as opposed to Allegheny County, where there are many, many nursing homes, and most of them, of course, are private.
Right.
So have you run into that question about access to the nursing homes?
In our area, no. Now, that could be that could just be my own ignorance, or it could be that even our rural areas, because we've always had a large elderly population, there has always been a nursing home industry capable of taking care of those individuals who need it. There could be other states that are, in general, largely rural states, places where the aging population has all of a sudden become much bigger, and maybe those are places that are having problems because there are not that many new nursing homes being built.
The county commissioners of the counties that have been privatizing just very, very recently, earlier this summer and even over the past several years, as you enumerated earlier in our discussion, are they taking any steps to sort of ease any concern about whether my family member will have access to a nursing home once it becomes privatized?
They often put covenants, as they're called, into the sales contract. So there's an agreement where the purchaser of the county-owned nursing home has to commit to for maintaining the same number of Medicaid reimbursed beds so that the lower income population is always going to have to be guaranteed these beds. My impression, that's probably a public relations gesture more than anything, because for any nursing home to survive these days, they need to take a large number of Medicaid recipients because there are just not that many people able to pay privately with their own resources for nursing homes. Those agreements are there. I have not heard much about Medicaid recipients have a hard time anywhere getting into a nursing home.
All right. So cost, accessibility. Let's talk about briefly quality of care. Let's hear again from Nicholas Castle from Pitt's Graduate School of Public Health.
The state comes in and each year to a facility and inspects the care that's given and see that the codes are up to standard and that there's enough staff and things like that. So they do that in all facilities. It doesn't matter whether you're for-profit or not-for-profit.
Do we know if there's any evidence of a difference in quality of care between public and privately operated?
Not between public and private. Not when you specifically talk about a county-owned nursing home. There have been some studies that have shown that nonprofit nursing homes in general, out in the privately owned sector have higher staffing and perhaps better ratings from the government than privately for-profit homes. I have not found anything on this specific topic to say, well, if a county-owned nursing home is sold, we should all be worried. I think it's going to depend on who buys it, what the track record is, and if county commissioners are doing their jobs, they are vetting these potential purchasers seriously to get the best quality one with a track record that would ensure quality care. There are no guarantees.
All right. So Rich Fitzgerald, our county executive, said for the foreseeable future, his term, the Canes are in good shape, but he's still concerned about federal funding, specifically Medicaid.
That goes for a whole lot of issues, not just with the Canes, but for our own county employees, for the folks that rely on Medicaid expansion that comes through the state and sometimes is shared by the county. So I think the whole healthcare funding situation is right now a little bit unclear.
When you talked to Rich Fitzgerald as well, did you get a sense of, I don't want to guarantee they'll be here, but he said the foreseeable future?
There was nothing in there that to me said he's going to change his mind 5 years, assuming he's the county executive then.
Right.
But everybody in the industry has a lot of uncertainty right now over the debate in Washington about Medicaid funding, caps on spending for it, because that money trickles down from the federal government to the state. The state has a Medicaid budget that then a certain percentage goes to nursing homes, a certain percentage to home and communities-based care. If there's fewer dollars to deal with, how does that affect nursing homes and what happens to the beds for Medicaid? That's a real crapshoot right now that neither I nor Rich Fitzgerald or anyone else can tell you where that's going to be 5, 10, 20 years from now.
Gary Rutstein is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Gary, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a big boom in infrastructure, pipeline building, but who's keeping an eye on it? That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA.
Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Johnstown, Pennsylvania experienced what weather experts called a 500-year storm in 1977, with nearly a foot of rain in 10 hours. 88 people died, 5 local dams in the city failed as the rivers reached up to 11 feet. The flood followed the construction of the River Channelization Project, which was meant to make Johnstown flood-free nearly a decade after the devastating 1889 flood. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for July 21st, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There's an infrastructure boom going on, but it doesn't necessarily mean orange cones, detour signs, lane closures across the Northeast. There's a bit of a rush to build new natural gas pipelines, and that includes Pennsylvania. But who's regulating, approving this construction? What are the concerns? Well, we're going to talk about all that with Jamie Smith Hopkins, reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, which partnered with State Impact Pennsylvania for a series of reports on the booming pipeline construction in Pennsylvania. Welcome, Jamie. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on.
And joining us in studio is Jared Stonecipher. He's the energy reporter for the Beaver County Times. Jared, thanks so much.
A pleasure being here.
If you have a question or comment, you can just tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Jamie, let's start with you. Your story boils down to a dispute about how far the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, can or should go when determining whether new pipelines are, number one, in the public interest, and number two, have a minimal environmental impact, correct?
That's right. Yeah, if they're needed, that's right. So we started looking into this because there is, as you point out, a pipeline building boom going on in the Appalachian Basin area, so it includes Pennsylvania. Over the years, a number of people have called FERC a rubber stamp for the energy industry, that they just approve gas pipelines regardless of whether they're needed or not. So we wanted to look into this a little bit. First off, we delved into the question of what the record had been across the country, not just in Pennsylvania and nearby states. My coworker, Kristen Lombardi, looked through this and found that over the past 30 years, FERC has only rejected two proposed pipelines out of hundreds proposed.
Okay. Let's backtrack a little bit. I want to get a sense of just how extensive this is. Jared, let's start with you, and then if you will follow up, Jamie. So what is in place? What's under construction? What is proposed? Jared, we'll start with you, Jared.
We've been hearing for years, since the Marcellus Shale boom started, that a big need is more pipeline infrastructure. We're finally starting to see that. Speaking just for Beaver County alone, there is one project already underway called the Revolution Pipeline. It's already under construction. It's going from northeast Beaver County down to the southwest. We'll go into Washington County. And then there's also another project planned by Shell Pipeline. Obviously, the Shell cracker plant, folks are familiar with that. That project has not started. Shell is still in the process of securing land easements, everything they need for that. So that won't kick into gear here for about another year. But it's two projects in Beaver County that are really ramping up ramping up.
And Jamie, in other parts of the state, just how extensive is this, both in what's there now and what is proposed?
Sure. Yeah. We look specifically at interstate pipelines, those are the ones that FERC oversees. Of course, there are additional ones beyond that that are just intrastate. But of the major pipelines that we looked at, there's 11 of them. Significant ones all came to FERC as proposals in 2015 that would run through Pennsylvania, Ohio, or West Virginia, or in some cases more than one of those states, to bring gas to other markets. New or expanded pipelines, and some of them stretch hundreds of miles. FERC has approved 5 of the 11 so far. The rest are awaiting decision. So far, FERC has given positive assessments of these proposals. Four of the 5 that FERC has approved start in Pennsylvania. So that's quite a few.
Jared, for the ones that you mentioned going through Beaver County, are they in the FERC process yet, or do we know where they are?
Shell's is definitely not in the FERC process yet. They still haven't even begun the process of securing permits and what they need to build. They're still negotiating with landowners. From what they've told me, they're making good progress. I think they've secured about half of the easements they need to secure before the project can kind of break ground. But I'm sure the permitting process is obviously going to start very soon. That's something that they need to start very soon. They say that they want to start construction sometime next year and have it done by 2020. So Shell is a multi-billion-dollar national company, multinational company. They know what they're doing. So I'm sure that they have the process that they're going to go on their own timeline. But no, they have not started the permitting process yet. But they're hoping that when it does start, they can go through it quickly, because they're going to build quickly. That's how they do. Everything they do is pretty quickly. So I'm sure that whenever that time comes, they'll be ready.
All right, Jamie. Jared mentioned timeline. Is it a long process to get FERC approval? Does it vary from project proposal to project proposal? What questions are asked by FERC?
It does vary. Bigger projects tend to take longer, as you would expect. Estimates that a typical project takes less than a year, but that those are smaller ones. The ones that we were looking at are more substantial, and it can be several years. At the point that it comes to FERC as an official proposal, frequently companies will come to FERC before it's officially proposed to sort of kickstart the process to begin getting community input early. And so that sort of if you count that, you're talking additional years as well. But in any case, just to give you an idea, the projects that we looked particularly at all came in 2015. It was a big year. So now 5 of those are approved, and the other 6 could start being approved later this year once FERC has a quorum.
I want to talk about public input and process. We'll start with you, Jared, and even if they haven't started the FERC process just yet, are you hearing any public protests?
Most definitely. Shell has been a harbinger on both sides. Definitely. We're hearing from folks who are afraid that their water sources could be tainted by a pipeline. Obviously, over the border in Ohio, you have the Rover pipeline, and there have been documented incidents with that. Then to the east, you have Mariner East, which has obviously had its issues also. So I think the feeling in Beaver County amongst some folks is that it's only a matter of time until issues like this come to Beaver County. With two pipeline projects kind of crisscrossing the county, there are folks who are worried. There's the Ambridge Reservoir kind of right there in Beaver County, serves, you know, tens of thousands of customers. And there are people who have started a petition to try to ask the Ambridge Water Authority to do all they can to ensure their drinking water is going to be safe. And I think that these folks are also going to welcome the process for FERC to submit their either written or oral comments to maybe voice their concerns about this.
Jamie, how much is public input protest considered, and does FERC ever say no?
Well, there's two occasions that we're aware of in the last 30 years where FERC did say no. And key to those denials, a key part of that was that the companies simply didn't have contracts, the contracts to show that there was market demand. And so, you know, that there was, at least in one of those cases, I know there was substantial concern and opposition in addition, but the lack of contracts really was fatal to that project. So FERC takes public comment and, in fact, gets thousands of comments on some of these bigger projects. The complaint that we hear from residents is that they feel like it's very hard to participate fully because it's such a technical process. And so you need money to hire consultants in some cases to look deeply into projects or to hire attorneys, and that can be tricky.
So the denial came on not having the contracts to supply the energy, not necessarily people up in arms about it. Is that accurate?
Well, in one case, there were people were up in arms, but was critical was a lack of contracts. And those were, I should specify, contracts between the pipeline company and the companies that wanted to use the space inside the pipeline to move gas. So those customers can be utilities. It could be gas producers trying to move their gas somewhere else, a variety of different customers. And for FERC, seeing those contracts in place is really key.
So I believe you reported that some former FERC commissioners, again, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, said the agency has little leeway to deny a pipeline. They're restricted on how they can deny a project?
Sure. So, you know, obviously everybody can define public interest differently. They've been pushed to consider the potential effect on climate or, you know, the local environment on people's properties as part of the public interest. And FERC says that it considers a wide variety of things. But it's very interested in making sure that that people get the energy they need, that the infrastructure is there is in place, and so that's a key part of what they're looking at is there demand as shown by the contracts for this pipeline, and that's caused some controversy because you could have contracts. In fact, a number of these pipelines do have contracts where there's more going on than simple clear domestic demand. Some of these pipelines, rivers among them, are some of the spaces set aside for gas to go to Canada. And there's a there are other some of these other pipelines are being have been proposed by companies that have, so you know, one side of the company, an affiliate, wants to build the pipeline, and another part of the parent company, you know, a utility they own, plans to use that space, some or a good bit of it. And so we talked to analysts who pointed out that this can cause concerns that maybe the need isn't entirely there because building pipeline can be profitable.
Well, let's talk about the need to both of you, and we'll start with Jared. I believe, Jamie, in your report, you said U.S. Energy Information Administration predicting the country will produce more gas than it's capable of using. But to both of you again, isn't it the intent to become an energy exporter? And how could this affect ratepayers? I'll start with you, Jared.
Well, Shell's project is a little different because their pipeline isn't going to be transporting gas to market. It's going to be a pipeline built by Shell to supply to Shell. So in that, there's a lot of different restrictions there. For instance, Shell cannot do eminent domain, where if you can prove that a project is in the public good, you can do eminent domain. With Shell, they can't do that. This is a private project for their own use. So they're going through a rather cumbersome process of having to secure easements from every single landowner that the pipeline is going to travel through. So it's a bit of a different process for them. But I know for the other pipeline coming through Beaver County, it's going to go from a compressor station in Butler County down through Beaver County into Washington County. And that's just one of obviously many across the state we're seeing where the gas is here. Everyone knows the gas is here. It's been here for a long time. And we're finally getting it out, but we need to get it to market. And that's what people have been saying for years. Now we're finally seeing, I think, a lot of these projects catch up despite some somewhat significant opposition to them.
And Jamie, what about that producing or getting to be able to produce more than's actually needed domestically?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question because certainly, you've heard arguments about the advantages of exporting energy, both sort of geopolitically and just for businesses' bottom lines. The fact, though, that the projects we're looking at are getting eminent domain, unlike the project that was just mentioned, means that people are raising concerns about, hey, why is part of my land being taken in an easement where I don't have any say, I don't have the ability to say no, specifically for export. People have raised the concern that this isn't fair.
We just have a few minutes left. I want to talk about the environmental impact. Environmentalists say each additional gas pipeline will make it easier to delay the no-carbon alternatives that were promoted by the Obama administration. Let's hear from Robert Howarth, an environmental biology professor at Cornell, who calls it a true climate disaster.
For FERC to say that their responsibility is just to look at one small piece of that intermediate connection and ignore the climate aspects of the build-out, I think is a tragic mistake.
All right. First Jared, then Jamie. What are you hearing from environmental advocates?
Well, Beaver County has about 170,000 people in it, and I think the most vocal minority has been about 1,000 folks. So we're not talking about a huge part of the population, but those who are speaking up are very vocal about it. They're letting it known, especially with the Shell cracker plant, too. They're concerned about the air, and with pipelines, they're concerned about their water. These are people who are very passionate, but I think they are also very frustrated because going through the permitting process with agencies like DEP and even FERC, they feel that their voices are being drowned out by companies, by industry advocates. So I don't think that they're feeling that their voices are heard. So they're doing really all they can, which is where the Ambridge petition comes up that has, a couple thousand signatures. But I think that either on the local, state, or federal level, these folks aren't feeling like they're being taken seriously.
And in our remaining minute left, Jamie, what do you hear from environmental advocates?
Right. Their concern is that because it's such a big build-out, it would allow a doubling of the amount of gas that could flow from the Appalachian region. That this is locking in the use of a lot of fossil fuels for decades into the future. These pipelines are built to last, about 50 years, at a time when their concern is this is going the wrong direction. That we don't have that long to move to something that is not going to be a problem for the climate.
Just 30 seconds left. Just a very brief answer from both of you. As you explore this issue, pipeline construction, what question do you want answered quickly, Jamie?
What question do I want answered?
Yeah, what are you looking for?
Well, there's a lot of them. And right now we're waiting to see what does FERC do with the rest of these pipeline proposals. Does it continue to make decisions similar to the ones that it has?
All right. And Jared?
I think in Beaver County, the issue is where exactly is Shell's pipeline going to be? They've said before that they're going to take great strides to avoid environmental areas and population centers, but they have not actually said where the pipeline is going to be yet. And I think that's causing a lot of concern amongst some environmentalists in the county.
Jared Stonecipher is an energy reporter for the Beaver County Times. Jamie Smith Hopkins is a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity in Washington. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Production assistance and research from Katie Zilkowski. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.